This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. On this podcast, we'll shine a spotlight on the rise of pregnancy accommodation laws and what they mean for employers and employees alike. There's no question it's become a growing trend nationally, with new pregnancy accommodation measures in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Nevada. For a closer look at these developments, we're joined by a longtime employment lawyer from one of those affected states, Kathy Rubin. Kathy practices in Boston with Hirsch Roberts Weinstein, where she represents employers. She speaks frequently on key employment issues and is a certified trainer in reasonable accommodation. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Kathy, what's been the driving force behind these pregnancy accommodation laws from your standpoint?
Well, David, employers generally sort of get the concept that you need to provide reasonable accommodation to employees who have disabilities. But pregnancy is not considered a disability. So when you think about the disability discrimination laws, there's two components. There's a thou shalt not discriminate component, and then there's a thou shall do the following, which is you shall provide reasonable accommodation. And the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was only the thou shalt not part. You can't discriminate, but the part that was missing was the requirement to provide reasonable accommodation. And the way the law was being interpreted is that pregnancy-related disabilities were covered, but pregnancy, a normal, healthy pregnancy itself, was not. And that, I believe, is what's driving these laws.
Now, in 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a big pregnancy discrimination ruling in favor of a female UPS driver who the company had failed to accommodate during her pregnancy. That case involved a lifting requirement. So where do things stand now for employers nationwide in terms of these types of requirements?
Well, there are a lot of employers that do have lifting restrictions. And what happened at UPS is UPS routinely would offer reasonable accommodation to employees who, due to an injury or a disability, were unable to do heavy lifting. But they weren't offering that same accommodation to pregnant workers. And the argument that was made by Young and supported by the EEOC was, well, wait a minute, if you can do it for them, why can't you do it for me? And by not doing it for me, you're discriminating against me because I'm pregnant. And so the court did not go so far as to say that pregnant workers have the exact same rights to reasonable accommodation as disabled workers. But what the court said is, look, if you're gonna treat pregnant workers differently, you better have a good reason. And the good reason can't be simply, well, I've already got to accommodate all these disabled persons, I don't want to accommodate you too. So what does that mean for employers? If someone is unable to do lifting for whatever reason, whether it's because they were injured on the job, whether it's because they have a disability, or whether it's because they're pregnant, the analysis is going to be the same for the employer. You're going to assess, number one, is lifting an essential function of this job? And are there accommodations that would either enable this person to do the lifting, whether it's special equipment or what have you, or would relieving them of the requirement that they do lifting for some period of time cause an undue hardship? It's the same approach and the same analysis.
That's a great point you made with the analogy versus disabled workers, because it seemed significant in that case that UPS was accommodating disabled individuals with its lifting requirement, but wouldn't do the same for Young, who brought the case. So what's the big lesson there that you take away for employers?
What employers have to realize is, you know, sometimes you hear the expression, no good deed goes unpunished. And I don't want to put it that way, because we want employers to be accommodating. But if you are accommodating to one group of workers, you are establishing the fact that that is something that you're able to do, that it's not a hardship. So if you're not going to offer it to somebody else, you better have a darn good reason why, one that's unrelated to the fact that, well, that's because they're pregnant. So another example of where this particular dynamic comes up is a lot of companies have policies that say, well, if you're injured on the job, we'll give you light duty, but if your injury is outside of the job, we won't give you light duty. And some state courts have said, well, that's okay, that's not discrimination. But other courts, including some courts in my state of Massachusetts, have said, no, if you could do it for a person who's injured on the job, then it wouldn't be undue hardship to do it for people who are disabled due to other purposes. So basically the idea is consistency of treatment amongst groups of employees without regard to the cause of their inability to carry out the particular job function.
Interesting. And I guess employers had best tread cautiously in claiming undue hardship too quickly, because I would imagine that they've really got to have good evidence there if that's going to be their defense.
One thing that is both troubling and good about the case law and the interpretation around undue hardship is there is some flexibility built in. For example, when Congress was looking at the ADA, there was talk about, well, should we say that it's automatically undue hardship if it costs more than X percent of the employer's revenues? And that didn't go through. And the thought was, this is really a case-by-case analysis. So a small employer may be able to demonstrate undue hardship more readily than a large employer. Undue hardship is going to depend on what's going on in the particular program, what other employees are available, what resources the employer has, whether there are specific client needs, and it is going to differ based on the unique circumstances. That's a little frustrating for employers, because employers say, well, can't you just give me a straight answer, Kathy? Why is the answer always, it depends? But ultimately, I think that works out well. But you are correct. The employer just can't say, oh, this is hardship. They're going to have to demonstrate it. And in fact, our Massachusetts state law says that employers bear the burden of proof of demonstrating undue hardship. It's not that the employee has to prove that it wouldn't be undue hardship. The employer has to approve that it would be.
Kathy, on the state level, in the 2.5 years since the Supreme Court weighed in Young versus UPS, we're seeing laws that continue to expand the rights of pregnant employees. Do you think these developments are an outgrowth of what the Supreme Court had to say, or is something else at work?
It may be an outgrowth of what the Supreme Court had to say and the desire for sort of some sort of clarity around the issue. I think there's also increased recognition that we do not want a situation where women are more likely to lose their jobs just because women are the ones who give birth and men do not. Another interesting development that I think we're seeing in Massachusetts is with the fact that we now have a Republican administration, some of the agencies, like the NLRB or the EEOC, and with appointment of more conservative judges, we're going to see some restriction on expansive interpretations of employee rights. We may see some dialing back on regulations or on guidance in a way that's more friendly to the business community, more friendly to employers. And some states, I think, are sort of pushing back and saying, well, if the feds aren't going to do it, we're going to do it. So the federal government isn't going to provide these protections. We're going to provide it ourselves. And I think that we're seeing some of that in Massachusetts.
Well, speaking of Massachusetts, I noted at the top that your home state recently passed a pregnancy accommodation law that provides a host of examples of exactly what constitutes a reasonable accommodation. So what are you telling your clients and HR professionals about that new measure?
It is an expansive law, although to some extent, what's not new is we've always known that we had to provide reasonable accommodation to pregnancy-related conditions. And if a person's restricted from lifting, that can be deemed a pregnancy-related condition. But what I think the takeaway for the employers is you can't just say no. You can't say, you know, lifting is a requirement of this job. If you can't do lifting, you're not a qualified handicapped person, so therefore we don't have to accommodate you. The law sort of seems to skip past this issue of whether the person is qualified and goes right to the undue hardship analysis and says, if there are aspects of the job that the person can't perform, you have to engage in that dialogue. You need to explore whether offering them the various accommodations, whether it's time off, whether it's more breaks, whether it's light duty, temporary transfer, whether it would truly cause you undue hardship. And if you're going to take the position that it does, you're going to have to be able to document and demonstrate and show it. I think another sort of takeaway about the new law is I used to get a lot of questions that said, you know, a pregnant employee has applied for a position with our company, and under the Mass parental leave law, they wouldn't be eligible for parental leave for 3 months. This person is going to give birth in a couple of weeks, so I'm not going to have to provide them leave, will I? And under the new law, the new Pregnant Workers Fairness Protection Act, you cannot take pregnancy or the need for an accommodation, which includes a maternity leave, a leave for the purpose of giving birth, into account. And so it is not something that can be considered. So if somebody walks in for an interview and they're visibly pregnant and you know that person is going to need a leave and they're going to need a leave soon, that cannot be a factor in the decision-making process unless, and again, unless you can show that bringing this person on and granting them that leave very shortly after they were hired would cause you undue hardship. So an example for that might be you're hiring, you know, cases going to trial and you're bringing in some sort of a courtroom consultant. And if they're not going to be able to be there in court with you during those first 2 weeks of trial, that might be an undue hardship. But again, that's that case-by-case analysis with the burden on the employer.
Again, we're speaking with Kathy Rubin of Hirsch Roberts Weinstein in Boston. And Kathy, a number of the states that have passed these laws, not all, but most, have tended to be from the blue states, like your home state and Connecticut and some others. Do you think this is a trend that is likely to spread to other parts of the country as well, or not?
You know, I've noticed with the employment laws that there really are themes with regard to the states. So sometimes when I do training, I say, what do you think is the most employee-friendly state? And you hear talk about California, you hear talk about Massachusetts. Employees have to rely more on federal laws for protection. So I think that that trend is likely to continue, that you're going to see more of these types of laws in states which tend to take a more employee-friendly approach and tend to be more of the states that are the Democratic states.
Now, in terms of what you see in your work, what's the biggest mistake that you see employers making when it comes to dealing with pregnant employees?
So as I mentioned before, one big mistake is employers considering pregnancy in part of the hiring decision. I'll point out to them is, you know, if a woman walks in the door and you see that she's visibly pregnant, well, a man could walk in the door, you may not see, but that man may have a disability that's a hidden disability. Or he may have a wife who is pregnant and he's going to want time off for parental leave. And you really have to put blinders on with respect to pregnancy. It's like race or religion, it's considered not, for the most part, not relevant to the job, except for that true undue hardship exception. The other mistake I think I see is not doing that dialogue, a sort of snap judgments. And that's the case also with the disability discrimination laws generally. I had a client once, somebody asked if they could work from home. And the job was really not a job that was feasible for telecommuting. But my client made the mistake of saying, we don't do telecommuting, just didn't do the dialogue at all. And in disability discrimination cases, more and more, even if the accommodation being requested would not have been effective, would not have been reasonable, would have caused hardship, employers are getting in trouble because they didn't engage in the back and forth, the interactive dialogue. And Massachusetts law talks about it being timely and it being good faith, and employers would be well advised to document the fact that they've had that dialogue. It was great to meet with you. You have requested that we do X. X is not going to work for us because of Y, but we are willing to do Z. That kind of documentation can make all the difference in the ability of someone like myself to defend you in an action.
Yeah, that interactive process is just so important. But not all accommodations are necessarily reasonable, as your last comment kind of alluded. So how is an employer to tell the difference, so to speak, between one that is reasonable and one that is not? Because as even the Supreme Court said back in Young versus UPS, which we talked about at the top, pregnancy does not necessarily give someone most favored nation status. So what are your thoughts on that?
So you're absolutely right about that, that it doesn't. But again, treat it like any other disability. So step one is the employee comes forward and says, I need X. I need an accommodation. The first step in the process is to assess the person's needs and what's going on with them. So very often, you're going to ask for medical documentation with regard to what is going on with the person and what they specifically can and cannot do and what accommodations might work for them. I do want to note that in Massachusetts, our statute says that you can require documentation, but not for certain types of requests. Like if someone is just requesting a few more breaks or limits on lifting over 20 pounds, you can't require medical documentation. But otherwise, you can. So assess the person's needs, get medical documentation to confirm what the person can and can't do. Then you talk with the person about it. The person says, I want you to relieve me of the obligation to do any lifting. And maybe the employer says, well, if you can't do lifting, then say you're a human service provider working in a home caring for a disabled individual. If there's a fire and we need to evacuate the residents, you won't be able to do it. We have staffing ratios. We need to have a certain number of people present. And so if you can't do the lifting, we have to hire another full-time person. And we're a nonprofit. We can't afford that. Is there something else we could do? For example, is there special equipment that would help you to be able to do the lifting? Or could we have you switch around with this other employee so you do more of this particular type of task and they do more of the lifting? Or if lifting is required, there's someone that you can call for assistance. So you sort of go back and forth and you try to figure out what's going to work for both sides.
And in our final minute or two here, Kathy, what role do you think HR can play in helping employers to steer clear of trouble when dealing with these pregnancy issues in the workplace?
I would say that the emphasis on your question is what can HR do as opposed to what the managers can do. When I'm reviewing employee policies and they say, if you need a reasonable accommodation, go talk to your supervisor. No, don't go talk to the supervisor. Have them go to human resources because there are some nuances to how you interpret the laws, and to have someone who has the experience, has the expertise, knows what has been done for other employees. Supervisors can bungle this. They don't realize that, you know, across the plant floor, a different supervisor is allowing something that they're saying no to. So there's a risk of inconsistent treatment. Also, if a manager knows details about a person's condition, whether it's a pregnancy-related condition or some other disability, they can be accused of discriminating on that basis. They don't need to know the details. All they need to know is that the person needs an accommodation. Human resources goes through the dialogue, looks at all the medical records. The supervisor doesn't need to see all that stuff. And then says to the supervisor, this is what's needed. Can we make it happen? And then if there's any sort of claim of discrimination, the supervisor can truthfully say, I didn't know what this person's disability was. I didn't know the specifics about their medical condition. What I knew is that we needed to make these particular job modifications, and I made them. So I think the best thing that human resources can do is to try to set up a system where these kinds of requests get channeled through, whether it's human resources or a CFO or somebody who's in the know, to ensure company-wide consistency and to ensure that the rules and the new statutes in the applicable states are followed and followed properly. Managers don't necessarily have that training, and while we encourage employers to give managers training on the basics of disability discrimination and reasonable accommodation, they're not necessarily going to have the skill to do that interactive dialogue and, even more importantly, to document it properly.
Okay, well, we'll let that be the last word. Kathy Rubin practices with Hirsch Roberts Weinstein in Boston, where she represents employers. Kathy, thanks so much for your insights today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Continue checking our website regularly for more podcasts on key employment-related issues, including political extremism in the workplace And is predictive scheduling the next big thing? The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR, our subscription offering, or our 50-state employee handbook, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved.